All right, Kim Gordon, thanks very much. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Here we are in February, February 1st, a Wednesday afternoon. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped at the start, perhaps on this jobs report from ADP, but it has given up much of its earlier gains. We'll talk to Terry Savage about that a little bit later. Frank Sennett comes along with some of the stories in Crane Chicago Business, and one has to do with the contract with the city and American and United Airlines at O'Hare. It is coming up, and there's a thoughtful piece there about what the renegotiation of that contract might mean for the city. So excited to talk to Frank about that. And then finally, Richard Edelman, the CEO of Edelman, talks about their trust study and also what he found in Davos last week. We'll start with Terry Savage. He is on a phone line. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
I am glad to be here, although as I watch these markets and I watch economic news and then I factor in the political news, I think anybody who is talking about where do I put my money, how do I invest, making forecasts for anything has to start with something like assuming America still is here.
Well, you know? I think America is still going to be here, Terry, don't you?
In the form that we know it. No. I think that it's... I've seen terrible markets, I've seen terrible economies, and I've seen booms. But I have never seen so much uncertainty about so many critical issues, not only financial but social, that would impact anyone's decision about where to put money.
The thing is, it's happening so fast. I mean, usually when an administration...
Boom, boom, boom.
Right, you come out, you pick your issues, and you tick them off one by one. Not so for Donald Trump, man. He is throwing it all out there right away.
And the latest one is his comments on the U.S. dollar. And, that'll get lost because there's not a big constituency for, well, we need a strong dollar.
Is this what came out of the far...
The way there is for, this... we don't need immigration bans and so forth. But I think this is perhaps one of the more profound financial impacts that we've seen already. And that, aside from possible trade border tax, is his comments that the dollar is too strong. We should maybe talk about what that means.
Is this what came out of the meeting with the pharmaceutical leaders yesterday? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and he's talked this morning about this also.
Explain it for us.
Okay, well, let me start by saying this. A strong dollar means that American dollars can buy a lot more goods overseas. If it's strong against the Chinese currency, we can import a lot more Chinese stuff cheap. And historically, they've liked that for their currency to be weak, so they could sell us a lot of stuff. The euro itself has been very weak. It's been weak against the dollar. It's been weak because Europe is falling apart and has had a much tougher road to come back from the financial crisis of 2008 because the European Central Bank has said we're going to keep the euro undervalued. And that's been very good for German industry. Because a weak euro means German stuff, machinery, cars, whatever, looks very cheap to, for instance, U.S. buyers who can buy a lot more German machinery because the euro is weak. Now, there's great concern about the weak euro. Is it a sign maybe that the European Union is going to fall apart and there'll be a trade disruption and so forth? We've lived with a strong dollar for a long time. It's been our policy for many years that a strong dollar is good for America. But this morning, Donald Trump, in his inimitable way, said, hey, the Germans are taking advantage of us because they get to sell a lot of stuff because the euro is weak. So today we've had a president of the United States commenting on the fact that the strong dollar, a situation that's prevailed ever since the financial crisis, I've talked many times, hey, everybody wants to buy the dollar. Why? Not because our interest rates are so high, not because, but mainly because it's the safest place in the world. Well, the reaction to the president's comments was that the euro strengthened, the Japanese yen strengthened. The fact is, if we're going to have a weak dollar, gosh, we got more problems. If that's what he wants to do to get our businesses selling, we're going to have a lot more problems. So how could this – let me just make a quick jump.
Sure.
Giving you that scenario, today is one of those Fed meetings where practically no one – expects the Fed to raise interest rates.
I think there was a Reuters survey that said 4% of the people surveyed think it would go
exactly
up.
Exactly. I mean, all the market people, they don't think. So that's why we were, wasn't high on my list to talk about when I was thinking, what do we talk about today? However, we did have some strong economic news. You pointed out an incredibly strong employment number. some manufacturing numbers that are, look pretty good. And so, you know, maybe 4%, maybe 10% of traders thought the Fed would raise rates. But think about it. If the Fed were to raise rates, not obviously later today, but in the next month or the next month, what does that do? It makes the dollar more attractive. It makes the dollar stronger. People send their money from all over the world to the dollar because the interest rates here, as low as they are already higher than the rest of the world. So if the Fed raises rates again, you can be sure that Donald Trump will turn around and aim right at the very supposed to be independent Fed. So talk about all the battles that are being picked in Washington today. If the Fed does anything, even does its typical thing saying, well, we're planning to raise rates several times this year, you know, who knows where the president's attention will turn next and who he will berate publicly next.
All right. So that's
why it's so difficult.
That's one of those fires. And then there are fire, you know, the Senate Democrats walking out of committee hearings and the Republicans approving nominees anyway. We've got the Supreme Court nominee coming up. So, and then we have people, it's almost like it's not a two-person fight anymore. Or, you know, I'm thinking of the balances of power through history. It's not the Soviets and the Americans. It's not the Republicans and Democrats. There are these leftist forces marching. There is the Republican Party in one end, and in many ways, Donald Trump is separate from the Republican Party. So it seems as if there are all these different players, and if we talk about certainty in the market, it seems as if there's less now than ever.
Right. Now, you know, I think the American people have pretty well gotten used to over the years that Washington is just a dogfight. And we kind of got numb to that if it's the Congress walked out of the committee and the Democrats did it to the, you know, they wouldn't listen to a nomination. Now, the Republicans wouldn't. We're kind of used to that. But what America is not used to is a president just waking up one morning or maybe in the middle of the night and tweeting something or saying something off the cuff that could not only impact markets, forget that, but could impact the world power structure.
Okay,
hard to deal with.
We have to break, but you, having said that, if you look at the numbers, and I don't know that 6 or 7 or 8 weeks is something you can judge him by, but if you look at the numbers, the stocks have done very well since he's been waking up and tweeting off and all of that.
But, you know, we have a lot of let me just make this point. We have a lot of momentum from some good economic news. The jobs number that we got today was jobs growth in January before he was, you know, even inaugurated. So the economy had some momentum going for it. Not huge momentum, but some momentum. It remains to be seen the uncertainties that are being generated across the specter of political and economic issues in America, how businesses will react. They haven't talked about taxes yet. I just want to make one point. Where do you put your money? Now, interest rates, if the Fed's going to get in a war with the president's going to get in a war in the Fed's going to lay off raising rates. I'm looking at gold right now. I haven't mentioned gold on your show for a long time. It's $1,205 an ounce, down $5. It was a little higher yesterday when the comments about the dollar were made. I always have some gold stocks in my portfolio as insurance. And I'm thinking $1,200 is going to be a real interesting level because if the U.S. dollar is going to be weak and global currencies are going to be weak, your choices are stocks and gold. And you just asked it, how can the stock market keep going? And so I'm saying this is a time maybe for a little insurance, and I think gold stocks have not had a move in a long, long, long time. Maybe it's a time for some insurance.
All right, that's Terry Savage. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Terry is going to tell you why you do not want to be an NBA player. It's 12:24. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. It's Wednesday afternoon, so that means Terry Savage is there. And, Terry wrote a column that you can read at terrysavage.com about it's the best argument I've ever heard, Terry, for not becoming an NBA player. Was that your design?
Or an NFL player. I tied it
or a baseball player.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And by the way, if you're going to watch the Super Bowl this weekend or be forced into watching it or watch the commercials and you really don't know the difference between a tight end and a wide out and whatever.
We're not doing that, are we?
No.
Okay.
What I'm saying is if you want to add some interesting spice to the conversation, the column that's up this week at terrysavage.com is called The Super Bowl of Taxes, and it is filled with very interesting facts that will make all these football, you know, experts go, really? I didn't know that.
Well, I was interested in, so the idea is that people that, you know, and I knew this, that There are some cities that impose taxes on visiting teams when they come in and play. So you'd have to pay, say, a Philadelphia city tax or a Pennsylvania tax. And state taxes. And I think the baseball players were the highest, right, where they may pay 28 different states a year.
Yep. And also some in Canada because they play in Toronto. And football players, so here's your stat that you can just plop down, you know, when everybody else is discussing something sophisticated. You can say, did you know that football players typically have to file tax returns in 10 to 12 taxing jurisdictions, including some cities? By the way, you're right, NBA players file in 20 jurisdictions, and baseball and hockey, my God, that's international too.
Okay,
and
so
by
here's
the way, you can add, don't I give you one more little fact,
okay,
that it's not just the game day, the money they earn at a game that's taxed. They look at something called duty days in the state taxing authorities, which include spring training camp, practice days, travel days. So if they fly in the night before to New York City to play the Jets or whatever they are, the Giants, they have to pay the tax on being there for the day before, the day of the game, unless they fly out that afternoon, then the next day. So it's a huge bite. Plus, that applies not only to the players, who are going to make a lot of money in the Super Bowl, by the way. Probably each one will make an additional $100,000, the winners. And they've already won championship money for the championship games. But all the trainers, the coaches,
right?
If you think you've got tax hassles, believe me, if you're a traveling athlete or, by the way, an entertainer or maybe, and this applies to you out there, a salesperson who, you know, travels to Indiana or Ohio to write an order,
Terry,
you may owe taxes.
Or a college student. I did taxes for my daughter last week, filled out her taxes. She had two jobs in Ohio and one in Illinois. Next year, she's going to have a job in Illinois, two in Ohio, and one in Hawaii.
That's appropriate, Steve. She's smart and sophisticated.
Oh, it's wonderful.
She's earning enough to have to file a tax return.
No, it's wonderful.
No wonder she's your daughter.
God bless TurboTax. That's all I've got to say. Good to talk to you again, Terry.
Have a good Super Bowl weekend.
All right, and thank you.
When you're watching these guys make money.
Thank you for giving us our tax tidbits for the Super Bowl. We appreciate that. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, Frank Sennett is on the phone line. He joins us most Wednesdays to talk about some of the stories in Crane's Chicago business. And, Frank, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, sir.
I want to start with this story, a great story by Joe Cahill, about the future of O'Hare, this master lease agreement with the city of Chicago and American and United Airlines. It's coming up due next year, so it's time to renegotiate it. And the way it's renegotiated could have a huge impact on the future of the airport.
That's right. Currently, between them, United and American control 82% of O'Hare traffic, and they have exclusive rights to 89% of the 168 domestic gates at O'Hare.
So the idea is they've got the numbers,
yeah.
So then they've got the muscle in deciding what happens to O'Hare.
That's right. So when there are various proposals for, you know, new terminals, new runways, et cetera, those are paid for in part by the gate fees from those two airlines. And so they have some veto power. And what's changed, what's different this time is that we're out of the recession. These airlines are both, you know, profitable, doing well, and they want to add capacity. So there's a mutual desire. The city wants to have some more competition. They want to add some gates that are common gates that other carriers can use. And United and American want some more gates for themselves. So what Joe Cahill is suggesting is that this is probably a perfect opportunity to get kind of a win-win, to be able to give United and American some of what they want in exchange for more competition at O'Hare and hopefully lower prices and more choice for all of us who travel.
I would imagine that, I mean, if other airlines were to come in and come in greater numbers, the burden on United and American would be lessened a little bit, but so would their stranglehold on who flies in and out of the city.
That's right. I mean, and right now travel is doing quite well out of the airport, and On the other hand, the growth in passengers and in flights at O'Hare has not kept pace with other major airports, so there is a need for some expansion. We're looking at a big Terminal 2 project is what's at play here.
Yeah, I like that.
More gates and a customs station.
So yeah. Joe talks about that this, if they add more gates, was it 25% more gates? I don't remember exactly, but add that at Terminal 2, and then they could also use, put a customs station there, so more international flights that would sort of ease the burden from people traveling from Terminal 2 or wherever out to the international terminal.
Right, because Terminals 1, 2, and 3 are all connected. You can walk from one to the other. Terminal 5 is very separate, and so you have to take a shuttle. And so if there were some international flights coming into Terminal 2, it would be a lot easier to make some of those transitions.
And so negotiations are open, or what do we expect to come out of this?
Yeah, so right now this is the leverage moment. The city is, talking with the airlines. They're laying out their plans, and the current 30-year lease agreement expires in May 2018. So we've got about a year for this to all get set.
Will part of the redesign of O'Hare include a protesters area, or was that just a passing thing?
Yeah, I mean, that was crazy. Very seldom seen the terminals that full, except for when they had the TSA shortage last year.
So there's that. Okay, that's O'Hare. Let's stick to travel a little bit. You know, we've talked a lot about the temporary ban on travel from 7 countries imposed by the Trump administration. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think you don't realize the ripple effects until you start seeing statements from Ford Motor Company or from the University of Illinois or Northwestern or other corporations or from the tech world about how we depend now on this, not free flow, but, go back and forth of international travel and people in several different countries. And one of the areas that has been impacted is this idea of travel medicine, travel surgery, or what's the right term for that?
Well, medical tourism.
Medical tourism, and, okay.
Yeah. So this is the law of unintended consequences, as you say, kind of playing itself out. What does the travel ban mean? We're starting to find out some of these nooks and crannies. And one of the things that we're seeing in Chicago being a big medical center is potentially a loss of some very high paying clients, patients from other countries coming into the United States, coming into Chicago and other major medical center cities, and, being shunted off to Europe and other places if they feel that the travel restrictions might be extended to their countries, or if they're from one of the 7 countries where the travel restrictions are already in place. So, you know, ultimately, these are folks that you can get in and they're not doing, you know, the budget bargain basement treatment.
Right.
They're paying the top dollar. And so that helps sustain various hospitals, programs, and trickles down to, you know, more reasonable prices.
Well, look, it's not lost on students of history that the Shah of Iran was a medical tourist in, was it the Twin Cities? I'm not sure exactly where he was during much of the upheaval there that led to the revolution. I mean, he was ailing and ill and was one of those guys who came here for treatment. So did King Hussein of Jordan was one of those guys who came here for treatment. Now, I would imagine if King Abdullah from Jordan needed to come for treatment, he'd be okay. He's not on the list, but those are the sorts of people, I guess, that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And if there are other countries in the Middle East that are not on the list yet, the thought may be, well, do I want to come into the U.S. for some fairly significant treatments that may last a while? If the political situation may change yet again, I could be stranded here. I could be kicked out before my treatments are done. So it becomes a wild card. And obviously, it affects a small percentage of people, but it is something that could have an economic impact on the medical industry here and on, of course, those patients who are, you know, looking for this very high-tech treatment.
Yeah, it is a temporary ban. It's only 90 days, and so you could argue that they could come after that, but you're right. It's the idea of, like, well, what comes next? And if this happened, what might happen involving my country in the future? So the loss at Rush will be the gain for some hospital in Germany.
Potentially, yeah. So I thought it was really interesting lens into what's going on. An unreported story, and Kristen Schorsch for Cranes really took an interesting angle.
I did enjoy that. You're right. It's something we didn't think about so much. Well, here's something we all think about, how much money we make. And Glassdoor is out with a survey that shows, I'm so used to Chicago economic stories lagging behind the rest of the country. This Glassdoor study shows that Chicago wages are up 4.3% from a year ago, which is a full percentage point of the national, right? The national average, I think, was 3.2%.
That's right. And the median pay in Chicago is now at $56,279, compared with just $51,360 nationwide. You might say, you know, most of that will go to extra parking tickets, but see that as a
Well, right. I mean, that's part of it, isn't it? That cost of living comes into play. They're just talking here about input, not output.
Right, right. So, you know, in terms of how far does your dollar stretch, that's a different story. But we're doing quite well in terms of the wage increases.
I like Glassdoor because they rely on, I'm fascinated by them, I should say, because I suppose they're accurate. They certainly claim to be accurate, but they rely sort of on anonymous people going online and talking about their salaries, right? So they say that the median base pay for doctors in Chicago was $261,000. That seems to be not too shabby. I would imagine insurance eats into that, but $260,000, I think I could get by on that, Frank. How about you?
I think maybe, you know, I'd even take you out to lunch once in a while if I had that.
No one really believes that's true, but I want this conversation because even though the nurses' salaries went up 5.6%, they're still being paid $71,000. So the doctor and nurse, maybe they've got something to talk about over the patient during surgery tomorrow.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, the doctor isn't too upset by that conversation while he's got the telephone.
Look, my time's off the table, so I'm okay. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business, thanks for coming by today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:51. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Very glad that you're there. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate that. Also joining us this afternoon on a phone line is Richard Edelman, the CEO of Edelman, of course, the global communications and marketing firm. Mr. Edelman, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I got to start with a little family. I have a cousin from Dublin who's working in your Dubai office. So you certainly are a global company.
Awesome.
In fact, I just sent him a note on Twitter, so hopefully he'll be tuning in. I know that the trust barometer came out last month, and I want to talk to you about that. But even more recently than that, you were in Davos, and you know, we've been talking about, I was talking to John Najarian, who is from CNBC, about this Davos summit. And in many ways, the people collected there were the people being revolted against around the world. In fact, you even kind of write about that in a blog, calling it an unfamiliar and uneasy scene for them. Explain that for me.
Well, look, Davos has a lot of government officials. It has business leaders. It has NGOs. And I think everybody's trying to figure out populism. Everybody's trying to understand how we're going to help people get through automation and globalization and a sense of feeling of inequality. And it was a big subject.
Is populism a good thing or a bad thing?
The fact that the people are speaking up is important. The idea that, in fact, democracies reflect the needs of the people. But I don't think it's a positive if it becomes short-term and aggressive and that we lose the parts of America of being generous and of being welcoming to immigrants, particularly highly skilled. Like if your cousin, for example, wanted to move from Dubai to the States because he or she's outstanding,
right?
We should be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more difficult, right? So it's good to get more voices and everyone's voice involved, but when everyone starts carrying pitchforks and running, that's when things get a little out of hand.
Well, our trust barometer is very clear that people have lost faith in the system. More than half of Americans feel that way, and it's especially problematic for the Trump voters. And in fact, the Trump voters, only 15% of them trust trust media. That's a problem because media then becomes an echo chamber. People only listen to what they basically agree with.
Richard, you don't have to tell me that. You just have to read the text I get every day. That's pretty clear to me.
Yeah. Well, look, and also people prefer search over human editors, and they somehow are number one credible source is a person like yourself as opposed to an expert or an academic, and God knows, a CEO or a government leader.
But so that's significant, and it comes up in the barometer that people are more likely to believe their friend or their relative than they are someone who is, let's call them, from the informed elite, if you will. But so people are more likely to get...
This is a revolt, as you said, this is a revolt against the elites. It's a sense that, you know, in prior periods, the elites had better information. They acted on behalf of the mass population, right, and you can maybe become one of the elites. And I think the mass population doesn't believe that anymore and is mad, and is particularly mad about even the in the wake of the financial crisis where we spent $1 trillion bailing out, you know, financial industry and all this, and nobody was sent to jail.
Yeah,
they want to see somebody responsible.
Interesting that you bring that up. I don't remember your exact words, but the idea was that the people used to think that the elite had access to better information, so they were willing to put more trust in them. Because really now we all have access almost to the same information. And is that where the trust falls apart, or are the elites sort of to blame for it as well?
Well, in fact, the mass population believes that they have better information,
yeah,
because
right,
they're talking to real employees who are doing real work, and not some, you know, buddy who's trying to spin. And that's business's big thing. Business actually has a tremendous opportunity here.
Business does better, right? Business is better than government and media and other institutions.
Business actually has emerged as the sort of last retaining wall in the tsunami. And I think CEOs who stood up over the weekend, Howard Schultz of Starbucks and others, are indicative of what has to happen. And it's not always going to, it shouldn't always be business against government. It can be business leading, explaining, you know, what's going to happen on automation of trucks, for
right,
example, driverless trucks. What are we going to do? How are we going to retrain people? What's their next jobs?
I want to go back to your blog post about Davos, where
sure,
you said maybe the most important speech was given by the president of China. And then just to read from what you wrote, if you closed your eyes, you could have imagined the same words uttered by President Obama, including a quote from Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. How is it that the Chinese leader is speaking more in favor of globalization than a U.S. leader?
Well, he said specifically that if you are protectionist, you're living in a darkened room. And that the best thing China ever did was to enter the World Trade Organization and expose its industries to competition. Now, look, we have to compete with the Chinese. We have to figure out the right way to protect our intellectual property and whatever. But he was a leader, and he wasn't, you know, angry or other. He was welcoming and saying, you know, China wants to, frankly, you know, be the beacon of the future.
Right.
And that's really where America should go.
There is this conflict about, you know, the rise of populism where people believe that they're finally being heard, and then those very people being told that the rise of populism is a dangerous thing for the world order. I mean, so you've got to really balance any sort of response or message to that, I would imagine. And messages are what you guys do.
But here's the thing. Right now, people are scared of innovation. That's a bad place for us to be.
Right.
Innovation shouldn't be, hey, you know, we're going to replace you with a robot. Innovation should be, we're going to make your life better. And by the way, if you are displaced, we're going to take care of you with job training and some money.
And in some cases, that stuff exists, but the people who would benefit it don't believe it exists.
Well, I'm not sure they know. I'm not sure that they're... in a sense, willing to change. But the jobs that have been lost, four-fifths of them are to automation. One-fifth of them are to globalization. And you'd never know that from the rhetoric about Mexico and China.
Yeah, that's an important part, too. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Richard Edelman, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.